Hey, this is Cedric Youngelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Before we get into this very special episode with Pierre Richard on proof of work versus proof of stake, rising communism in the world, and spirituality and money, I'd like to share a few words about our sponsors. First up is CrowdHealth. What if you didn't have to pay healthcare premiums anymore? What if you could invest in Bitcoin instead? With CrowdHealth, you can put aside money for health expenses in your own account and even hold a large part of it in Bitcoin. If Bitcoin goes up, you get the upside, not big insurance companies. Pay one low monthly total to fund an account that is yours. Choose your doctors, get great healthcare, and hold up to 75% of the balance in Bitcoin every month. If a large expense comes up, CrowdHealth will help negotiate and crowdfund the bill for you. Stop supporting the broken health insurance system with your hard-earned capital. Right now, you can get your first 6 months for just $99 per month. That's just a fraction of high-deductible insurance plans. Go to joincrowdhealth.com and use code MATRIX now and experience freedom from health insurance by utilizing Bitcoin. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. CipherSafe has a long heritage of creating quality and, I think, beautiful metal products. Their parent company, NumberAll, has been doing it since 1930. With Bitcoin slowly changing people's time preference, they feel it's a great time to focus on making artistic metal items. People can again start to appreciate an item for its beauty and the craftsmanship it took to make it. The Bitcoin Rouleau Triangle is a fusion of engineering, geometry, and Bitcoin. They achieved a beautiful textured surface for an almost diamond-coated look. I know you'll find the Bitcoin Rouleau Triangle to be as beautiful as I do. For more information, go to CipherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. If you enjoy the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, you can help support the show by doing the following. Send a tip on Twitter, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Fountain, or wherever you dome your podcasts. Leave a dope review on iTunes. Share the show and episodes with your friends and family. And as always, thank you for listening. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with the one and only Pierre Richard.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Pierre Richard is the VP of Research at Riot Blockchain. He is the co-founder of Nakamoto Institute and the co-host of the noted podcast with Bitstein, aka Michael Goldstein. And he's the co-host of the Bitcoin for Advisors podcast with Morgan Richard, who have both been guests on this show. Bitstein was on episode number 34, Everyone's a Scammer, Praxeology and Advanced Geopolitical Meme Warfare. And Morgan was on episode 77, Building Wealth, Eliminating Financial Stress, Achieving Financial Freedom, and Bitcoin. Both tremendous episodes. However, Pierre was the very first guest on this podcast and my Morpheus on this journey. In episode 1, we discussed accumulating Bitcoin, libertarianism, and anarcho-capitalism. I suggest people go back and take a listen to that key episode and check it out. Pierre joined us for two very special group chats. Episode number 13, the 2020 election night special with Heavily Armed Clown and Guy Swan. Episode 22, the Thanksgiving special with Jimmy Song, Surfer Jim, Katie the Russian, and Knut Svon Holm. He was also in episode 65, Bitcoin FOMO, ADHD, post-internet stress disorder, and speculative attacks. Pierre Richard, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast for the fifth time. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, it's great to reconnect. You seem like you've been up to a lot over the last, I don't know, year or so. Primarily, you have a new role, which I'd love to hear about.
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of months ago, I joined Riot as their VP of research. Riot is one of the largest Bitcoin miners in the world. So very excited to be joining the company on the inside. I had been on their advisory board for the past 3 years, so I got to see their astronomical growth, it seemed like the right time to be getting into proof of work, because lots of people are debating, you know, proof of work. Do we really need work? it's awesome to be joining that team. And it's a team that's really, I think, out executed everyone else in the industry. But, I'm sure that lively debate would ensue for that. it's continuing to grow as well. They recently announced they're building a second data center for Bitcoin mining in Corsicana, which is just south of Dallas. Lots going on.
Yeah, that's exciting. I do want to get into proof of work. So maybe you could give us a bit of an overview of what is proof of work and what is proof of stake.
Yeah, sure. So fundamentally, proof of work on its own actually has existed for far longer than Bitcoin has. I believe it was formally, the term at least started getting used in the 90s. And then it was also used by Adam Back in his Hashcash implementation. And that was cited then in Satoshi's white paper. And really, though, I think people use the term proof of work as shorthand for Bitcoin's what's called Nakamoto consensus, of basically this idea of how do we order transactions so that we don't spend the same coin twice, solving kind of the famous double spending problem. Traditionally, the way that that problem is solved is with a centralized player like a bank ordering the transactions however they want to. Now, normally you would think that they would order the transactions chronologically based on when they came in, but there are actually... there was a scandal recently about how they would reorder the transactions in order to maximize the overdraft fees charged to people. So they would debit the biggest, expenses first and then the smallest expenses last, so that they charge that fixed fee to the customer. Anyway, that's a little aside. So basically, with a decentralized cash system, electronic cash system, you need to have a decentralized way of ordering the transactions. And that's what Satoshi solved with the combination of the proof of work mechanism and the difficulty adjustment mechanism. Now, concretely, what it is that you can, there's a lot of moving parts to it, but let's just start with what the proof of work is. In Bitcoin, the proof of work is a hash, actually a double hash, SHA-256 squared, of what's called the block header. This data structure is a metadata of the block. So it has information about the block. Perhaps most importantly, it has the hash of the previous block, and it has the root of the Merkle tree of the transactions that are included in the block, meaning that you take each transaction ID in the block, you combine them all into a Merkle tree, and then you get this very short hash that is essentially a summary of all the, or a cryptographic fingerprint of all the transactions that are included in the block. And that goes into the block header. So what the miner is trying to do is to generate a hash of the block header that has a certain number of leading zeros in it. And the number of leading zeros is not up to the miner to decide. It's actually up to the Bitcoin nodes. The Bitcoin network decides how many leading zeros there are to be in a given hash of a block header, in order to win the block reward. Because every miner, when they are proposing a block, so they're proposing a block header, and that block has a transaction in it, that is the first transaction in the block and that is paying the miner. That's called the Coinbase transaction. It has nothing to do with the exchange. Brian Armstrong stole that word from Bitcoin, of course. And the hash, so it has a certain number of leading zeros, and the number of leading zeros actually gets recalibrated approximately, well, exactly every 2 weeks worth of blocks, which can be a little bit longer or a little bit shorter than an actual 2 weeks, on the calendar, just depending basically on how quickly blocks are coming in and thus how much has hash rate been increasing. So when hash rate is increasing very quickly, blocks come in a little bit faster. And so instead of having 10 minutes on average between every block, you might have like 8 or 9 minutes between every block, meaning that after perhaps 10 or 12 days, you get this difficulty adjustment where the nodes look back on all those blocks. They determine whether to increase or decrease the difficulty, that is to ask for more leading zeros or fewer leading zeros. And so the nodes are very much as they are calibrating this proof of work mechanism so that on average you get a block every 10 minutes. And that is what provides you with the ordering of sets of transactions. And so you get a new set of transactions every 10 minutes and it builds on top of a previous set of transactions. And so that's how proof of work functions. Now, the criticism of proof of work is that in order to find a winning hash, the miners, that is the hashers who are generating hashes, have to generate a lot of hashes because it's basically random luck that they find a hash with the number of leading zeros. If that was not the case, then they would be able to instantly find blocks and you'd never be able to get the 10 minutes in between blocks. So it really is the fact that you have a lot of wasted hashes, quote unquote, that are filling the time between the blocks. And each hash takes up a certain amount of electricity to create. And so if you look at the latest hash rate, I think it were like 200 exahashes per second, which is an astronomical number, which translates into a tremendous amount of electricity consumption, which has some folks up in arms because they don't think that they think electricity consumption is bad because it is consuming a scarce resource in their minds. And so we need to be, optimizing for energy efficiency. Now, if we go to proof of stake, again, if we look at it in isolation, first of all, there are no systems today that are actually proof of stake. They all have something on top of it in order to fix it, because proof of stake doesn't actually work. It is subject to what are called long range attacks, because the stakers are, instead of providing hashes of the block headers, they're signing block headers. And that means that they can provide signatures for any number of different histories of the ledger, and be able to pretty trivially construct parallel histories of the ledger and then reveal them to their advantage, in order to double spend or censor or whatever it is. So generally, proof of stake has layered on top of it in order to fix it what you might call proof of authority. So proof of authority, it's just like a centralized system where either it's centralized based on a specific set of stakers who have the authority to finalize transactions and to checkpoint blocks, or it's the developers who set the checkpoints. So in either case, very different from Bitcoin. Proof of stake doesn't solve the double spending problem in a decentralized way. So that's where people say like, oh, you should just use a SQL database because this is not particularly decentralized compared to proof of work, at least.
Yeah.
And then digging more into maybe proof of stake around maybe energy consumption, is it a reduction in energy consumption if we're just talking about hashes, or are there other sort of hidden costs to proof of stake around security or database management or computers or things maybe we're not thinking of?
Right. So this is a really interesting question, because whether proof of stake represents a reduction in energy consumption really depends on what the stakers spend their staking rewards on, right? So if they spend it on flights to, you know, Ethereum conferences, then arguably it has a bigger negative carbon footprint than Bitcoin mining does, because Bitcoin mining, you know, people have different estimates, but let's say it's like 50% of it is on zero carbon, you know, nuclear slash wind slash solar, or negative carbon like methane, you know, capture and things like that. You know, flying on an airplane, that's 100% carbon emissions, right? There's not like and it's also like, you know, directly into the upper atmosphere. It's like the worst possible kind of carbon emissions if we're, you know, looking at this scientifically. So it you know, the energy efficiency of proof of stake ultimately depends on what do stakers spend their staking rewards on.
And what did you make of the merge, maybe from a technological standpoint? Was that a difficult process?
Software upgrades are challenging even when you have a completely centralized system. So you have to applaud them for performing a software upgrade. You know, I've worked at companies where, you know, a significant software upgrade like this, you know, didn't go well, right? Or faced challenges or revealed some bugs and whatnot. It seems like it's gone rather well from a technical perspective. Now, did they do this in a decentralized way? No, not at all, right? So the staking, the proof of stake deposit contract that they deployed on Ethereum One, right, the proof of work chain, that was an official contract sanctioned by the Ethereum Foundation, or not sanctioned, that's a bad word to use in this context, but designated or created by the Ethereum Foundation as the official way to stake your Ethereum. So already from the get-go, there was no pretense of decentralization. Furthermore, they have this difficulty bomb mechanism of essentially being able to nuke all the nodes so that they're forced to upgrade.
Earlier, we were talking about time between blocks and sort of the difficulty adjustment, adjusting every 10, 12 days, depending on the time between blocks. How does each node know the time between blocks? And how is then their consensus on the time between blocks?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the miners, when they create the block header, they have a timestamp in it that says, here's the time at which I mine the block. Now, when the node receives that, it does not trust the miner. The node looks at its own clock and applies a certain window where if the timestamp is too far behind or too far ahead, then it rejects the block as invalid. But as long as the block's roughly within that window, it gets accepted.
And then how does it determine if it's been 9 minutes or 10 minutes between?
Yeah.
You know, and then so, how do they all agree that's happened and that's the amount of time, and then we have to make an adjustment?
Yeah, so the nodes are looking at their own system clock. So, you know, every computer has its own clock. Now, conceivably, your node's clock could be off, in which case that you'll be rejecting blocks that are seen as valid by other nodes, and then eventually you'll just get disconnected from the network. That's, you know, my understanding of it, at least. That would be an interesting topic to research, though, in depth.
Yeah, and I'd love to move to a little bit to your latest piece, the utility of savings. Is that, do I have the title right there?
Yeah, that's right. Although I thought you were going to talk about, I actually had a research report out recently with Joe Burnett from Blockware about transaction fees, but we can also talk about the utility of savings.
Yes, I would love to focus a little bit on the utility of savings. It opens up with sort of the critic's accusation, Bitcoin has no utility. And you reply, what the critics miss is that the utility of a monetary system is an inverse function of the uncertainty experienced by its users. How is Bitcoin the least uncertain monetary system in human history?
Yeah, great question. So I think the first misunderstanding is on volatility and risk versus uncertainty. So people look at Bitcoin's price, its exchange rate, its purchasing power, and they see something that is highly volatile, very risky, and thus, from their point of view, very uncertain. And I would argue that they are looking at Bitcoin from the outside. And if you look at Bitcoin from the inside, what you see, rather, is that the Bitcoin network and the software and the protocol are extremely stable and have been for the past decade. And what has been volatile is people's behavior on the outside. That is that, you know, there's a block on average every 10 minutes and the system has been doing exactly the same thing for the past decade, but people have been FOMOing in and out of the asset, driving its price up and down, and that it's the people who are volatile, not Bitcoin. And so if you look at like the uncertainty around, for example, multi-sig or single sig, or, you know, the nodes, node software, the miners, all these parts of the system are extremely stable. And it's that's what makes it an interesting monetary asset, even if the people around it are a little bit unstable.
Right. Stability, humans, maybe not the most. Why do people then hold money?
Yeah, so the fundamental reason to hold money is because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. And so if you knew exactly what was going to happen in the future, then you would know, you would be able to essentially arrange your affairs so that you never have to hold any money. You would, you know, distribute the money as you receive it instantly. And that way everything would be, you know, prepaid for. But, you know, the universe, human existence is full of uncertainty. So we don't necessarily know what we're going to spend on tomorrow or in a week or in 5 years. And that's what makes it useful to hold money.
Mm. You go on to say Bitcoin's purchasing power is an external quantitative risk that can be insured against, not an internal qualitative uncertainty. What do you mean by it can be insured against?
Yeah, so there's two ways to insure. One is by buying insurance. So, for example, if you buy or sell a futures contract, you lock in a certain price for Bitcoin in the future. And that way, you're not exposed to the volatility of it. You could do that with options as well. And the other way to do it is to self-insure. And the way that you self-insure is by holding more Bitcoin. So, for example, if you're, let's say you have $10,000 worth of Bitcoin today, and you're thinking about in 5 years, I'd like to buy a $10,000 car. Now, I'm worried that Bitcoin might go down 50%. So that means that you would want to accumulate twice as much Bitcoin just in case it goes down 50%. Now, if it doesn't go down 50%, well, that's, you know, profit, or it's a lack of loss, your self-insurance is essentially allowing you to pay yourself to take on the risk instead of paying somebody else, you know, with a futures contract that's going to have a cost associated with it.
So then what is the purpose of receiving Bitcoin?
So this is a great question because it's really ties into like merchant adoption and questions around that. I think everyone's always wondering, oh, where can I spend my Bitcoin and things like that. So I think that there's really probably three reasons why a business would want to receive Bitcoin. One is that the business owner wants to accumulate Bitcoin, and this is a great way of avoiding the fees of using an exchange. Two, it's actually a pretty great payment system. It operates 24/7, 365. It's right now it's got very low transaction fees, but if you use Lightning, you can get even lower routing fees on Lightning, and it has better privacy than any of the fiat payment systems, except for physical cash. But obviously, physical cash is often not an option if you're operating on the internet. But also, even in a physical business, it's better to be able to receive Bitcoin than physical cash, because that way you don't have to actually handle the physical cash, right? Because you can essentially have somebody send Bitcoin straight to your cold storage that might be in a multi-sig in a different location than the actual store. So it's just it's got so many different positive attributes in that regard. The only negative attribute, I think, is a lack of familiarity and a lack of developer tools, and kind of there's great projects that are solving for that, like BTC Pay Server. But at the end of the day, there just needs to be lots more education and adoption that way.
Yeah. I love how you go on to say people hold money to hedge against future uncertainty. This is why it is, but furthermore, the only purpose of receiving Bitcoin is to hold it. And the only purpose of sending Bitcoin is for someone else to hold it. All Bitcoin are always held by someone. Payments only change who is holding it. Fundamentally, Bitcoin is only savings technology, and transactions are just a feature within that product. So I wonder, why do you think Bitcoin is not performing like an inflation hedge against CPI right now?
Yeah, so I think that Bitcoin is a hedge against a very wide range of uncertainties. But if we look at, first of all, inflation is just, one of those. If you're looking to have a one-for-one hedge against inflation, there are derivatives that are specifically for that, for targeting consumer price inflation. But if we look at what is driving Bitcoin's exchange rate right now, I would argue that it has a lot more to do with adoption waves than with anything else. And so when there's a wave of adoption, the price goes up very quickly, and then once that wave subsides, the price crashes or corrects. Now, the adoption waves are driven by our herd mentality. So humans are very social animals. That's a good thing, right? You should love your neighbor, et cetera. But it also means that we're very vulnerable to memes and mind viruses. And so when Bitcoin, is actually getting kind of out of a previous bear market, then it starts building up momentum, and then lots of people FOMO in, and then it causes another bull market. So I think it's just kind of marching at its own drumbeat. Now, it also is affected by monetary policy. So right now, the Federal Reserve is contracting the money supply, and so that is, all else equal, a negative for Bitcoin. But in 2020, the Federal Reserve was rapidly expanding the money supply, and we did see Bitcoin go up to $60,000. So I think that Bitcoin essentially had an adoption wave, after that third halving, that coincided with that money printing. I don't think that there was necessarily a causal mechanism that, like, oh, the money printing was actually causing people to buy Bitcoin, even though there was like memes around it. It certainly added fuel to the fire. But I now that they are tightening monetary policy, even if there is consumer price inflation, that's just a result of what was going on 2 years ago. And so I don't see any kind of mechanical causal relationship between Bitcoin and consumer price inflation, even though like the skeptics say that the proponents say that there should be one. I don't agree.
Right. What about maybe any correlation? Or I think we've seen correlation to traditional markets and maybe even tech stocks. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so I think Bitcoin's always correlated with tech stocks and risk on assets, except for those periods of those adoption waves. And that's when it decorrelates and, you know, pumps up and then crashes down.
Do you foresee decoupling in the near future?
So I think that if we look at where Bitcoin is in the cycle, I would argue that we're scraping at the bottom here. And so if we look at past cycles, after you scrape at the bottom, generally have a year or 18 months before the next bull market starts in earnest, you know, of sideways. And, you know, we've seen these BARTs, right? The it pumps and then it dumps, you know, within days. And so I think that I would expect more of this sideways movement for a little while.
Sure. Do you think there's been any Bitcoin price suppression through futures markets or paper Bitcoin or even fractional reserve at exchanges?
Very skeptical of that. I think that anybody trying to do that would probably get wrecked because you never know when the price is going to pump. So, and it has in the past. And so it's very risky to be engaged in that. But
maybe a nation state.
Yeah, I'd have to see the evidence for it. To me, it seems like an extraordinary claim.
Fair enough. Do you think this cycle has been any different from previous Bitcoin cycles?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that there was just a lot of similarity. So, you know, we saw lots of people, you know, jumping into altcoins. I guess the new thing this cycle was NFTs, but there's a new thing every cycle. And so that's, you know, another similarity. I think the major thing is that transaction fees stayed very reasonable. So in December of 2017, transaction fees skyrocketed north of like $50 a transaction. You know, there were people paying like lots more than that. And in this cycle, we did not see that. So I think it was related to SegWit adoption and Lightning.
What kind of cycles do you think we'll see in transaction fees? And maybe what kind of projection are we headed towards? Are we maybe headed to a place where transaction fees are extremely high because this is a base layer settlement network, or maybe they're not astronomically high? I'm not saying they're as cheap as maybe what we'd see on Lightning, but where do you see it kind of going?
Yeah, so there's two ways that transaction fees could be high. Either there's not enough scaling innovation to increase capacity at the base layer, and so demand outstrips supply for block space, or there is censorship happening that is excluding transactions from blocks and causing transaction fees to go up. If neither of those are in place, then I would expect transaction fees to continue to be very low.
Returning a little bit earlier to around miners, in the future, do you think Bitcoin hashing is going to be something akin to 50% of energy consumption in the world, or closer to something like 1%?
Oh, I think it's going to be much less than 1%. I think that one, electricity production is going to dramatically increase. I think, lots of people want to have a first world lifestyle, which requires electricity. Two, the only way that electricity consumption would continue at this pace is if transaction fees went up. And I think transaction fees are, you know, going to be reasonable. They're not going to be exorbitant or super, super low. And yeah, there's definitely scaling innovation happening. So Taproot, you know, people talking about Fedimint, Lightning, obviously. So yeah, I think that there's pressure release valves for transaction fees on Bitcoin. So I don't think it'll be a material percentage of the electricity consumption.
I agree with you long term. I'm interested, I'm kind of curious, because you mentioned first world lifestyle, and it seems like, you know, we're going through one of those weeks where decades are happening. So I'm kind of curious what you think, you know, with Nord Stream, the bombing of Nord Stream, the Bank of England in the same week, and where the pound is going against the euro and the dollar. What do you sort of make of the economy right now and even geopolitics?
Yeah, so I think that as far as the global economy goes, you know, that the Federal Reserve, it seems as though it overreacted to the inflation, I would argue, or is increasing rates too quickly. And it's kind of like having somebody who is morbidly obese and saying, hey, you're going to run a marathon to get in shape. It's like, well, that's not going to work. You know, so even though it's directionally correct that, yeah, working out is how that person is going to get in shape, just having them start on a marathon is, you know, they're not going to make it. And so, yeah, I think that they are draining liquidity far too quickly, and that's causing global disruption because the U.S. is the world reserve currency. Now, how long they'll continue along this path before they have to pivot and start easing things, I think that's going to be driven by politics. The way I would look at it right now is that Joe Biden has somewhat given up on these midterms here in the U.S. And so he wants to front load the pain and have as much tightening as quickly as possible. That way, they can ease going into the 2024 election so that he stands a chance against Trump. Because if the Fed kind of drags out the pain and backloads it, or, you know, it's just slow, then that means that there would be tightening, you know, in during an election year, a presidential election year. And that would be disastrous for Biden or whoever is running for the Democrats.
How do you think, Bitcoin seemed to be built for quantitative easing. What do you think, how do you think Bitcoin's going to react to quantitative tightening?
Yeah, I think that people are still adopting Bitcoin for its fundamentals. And so, you know, at the end of the day, people want to control their own money and they want to have the freedom to use their own private keys and use their node, regardless of whether it's easing or tightening going on. It creates an opportunity, certainly, for folks to accumulate sats at a better price point when there's headwinds of, you know, this tightening, because that means that they're not competing against so many people or so many dollars chasing the same Bitcoin. Might be the same number of people, just, you know, fewer dollars, just because the Fed is taking dollars out of the system. And yeah, I think that it's really built for any season. And I also just don't think the tightening is going to last particularly long.
Do you think sort of capitalism is going up against communism right now in the world, with like the World Economic Forum? And
I wish it was communism. I mean, it's communism, or I don't wish it was communism, but at least communism promised to increase people's standard of living. Right. It was like, hey, we're going to redistribute wealth so that everyone's better off, you know, except for like the handful of capitalists, right? With this, I don't even know what to call it. It's not really environmentalism. It's like eco-terrorism. They essentially want to eradicate the human race from Earth, right? They see us as a cancer, you know, much like in the Matrix. It's like humans are a cancer. We have to remove them, or at least, you know, remove a lot of them. And it's really Malthusian type thinking of, oh, look, there's a limited number of resources. And with the trajectory that we're on, if we look long term, then, you know, we're going to, you know, damage the planet or something. So I think that's like the ideology. It's, to me, it's bizarre because, like, if we think about it long term, first of all, why is 2050 the longest term that we're willing to think about it? If you think about it in terms of billions of years, the sun is going to explode and incinerate the Earth. Like, that's, you know, that's what the scientists tell us. So I don't quite understand like their equation of, hey, look, we want the Earth to be doing great this century, even though we know that over the next, you know, 3 billion years that it's going to just get wiped out completely. I think that it, if we think about it very long term, we would say, okay, we need to use the resources we have at our disposal to become a spacefaring civilization. That seems like that would be the right approach. In which case, you know, we should look rather favorably of saying, let's use fossil fuels as a bridge to get to nuclear. And that, you know, we want to get everything on nuclear and be constantly improving nuclear because that is the most energy dense way of producing electricity and thus of, you know, being able to build up our civilization to be sustainably in space. It seems like there's a lot of pushback on this from what I would say that these are people who worship Mother Nature, like in a kind of a spiritual way. And to them, they see like primitive elements of wind and sun as being more noble than elements like fire, right? To them, fire is like very dangerous. So they don't like combustion. But wind and sun are good. And so they like solar and wind power. Even though if you look at the manufacturing process and the they also, you know, they like batteries too. They like batteries a lot, which is particularly odd because manufacturing batteries at scale requires mineral extraction on an epic scale, far greater than, you know, mining coal. But I think that in their minds, it's like, no, we're not going to do solar, wind and battery for everyone. We're going to do it for a select few and everyone else is just going to die. And so we don't have to like figure out the solution for like, you know, billions of people. We've got to figure out the solution for like 100 million people or something like that. So they are very much like a kind of Gaia Earth worshiping and misanthropic, you know, anti-civilization ideology. So I think that it's really important that we figure out how to deprogram these people. They're in a cult, and to get them back to reason, back to science, and to be thinking about, you know, how do we solve civilizational problems rather than try to destroy civilization. But yeah, it's going to be a long process. These people have been deeply brainwashed.
Do you think we're at an epic juncture where it's sort of, you know, panopticon versus, you know, maybe a chance at breaking through the Fermi paradox with Bitcoin and the great filter?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And so, you know, people are starting to see the consequences of this ideology, environmentalism. And I think that most people are naturally repulsed by it. So I do believe good wins in the end. And then it's just a matter of time frame, right? So the Soviet Union took 60 years to collapse. So that's, you know, things take a while to collapse. And for people now, other ideologies like Nazism and fascism, they collapsed much more quickly. So I think that hopefully environmentalism collapses and we're left with a more progressive, like pro-nuclear view of things.
Do you think there's spirituality in money?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's if you have a bad money, that is, if you can't hold money, then it actually incentivizes you to be more materialistic. And so spend your existence more in this kind of mass consumer mindset because you can't hold money. You have to consume. And so that materialism actually is bad for your soul, and it distracts you from, your spirituality, and vice versa. If you are incentivized to hold money, then you spend less money on distractions of any kind, and you spend more time on, yourself and your family and your spirituality.
Yeah. A few things I think you said earlier is materialism is sucking the life out and time out of you. It is also time consuming. And if you have more time, you can contemplate the ultimate ends. How is hodling Bitcoin the second highest form of charity?
Yeah, great question. So the greatest form of charity is to gainfully employ someone else. And so, we could debate about whether that is actually charity or not. I think that anybody who has been an employer would argue that there's some charity to it in the sense that you have to be charitable towards your employees because, there's a saying of if you want it done right, do it yourself. Right. And so in order to not do it yourself and not do it right, that's a sacrifice, right? And that I think is a form of charity of saying, hey, I'm going to actually hire somebody else to do this, and I'm going to pay them to do it. The second highest form of charity is giving anonymously to anonymous people, and this is really and without them knowing that you gave to them. And there's kind of an obvious reason why that would be better than if they did know that you gave that you gave them charity, because it preserves their dignity and their their self-worth and also their agency. So the way to do that is rather simple. If you have a money that cannot be inflated, you just hold money, and that increases the purchasing power of everyone else. And so you have donated purchasing power to them. They don't know that you donated it to them, and you don't know who you donated it to. And that is really the ideal form of charity, even if it's not commonly seen that way. I think that's the reality.
Sure. And to quote you back, holding money is the greatest form of charity, as it anonymously increases the purchasing power of those who need to spend while respecting the integrity of their dignity. Printing money is the opposite of that. So then the counter to that, or the kind of question is, where does toxicity fit into Bitcoin? Is toxicity a positive attribute to the system?
I think that there's tremendous diversity in the audiences of Bitcoin. So some people don't respond very well to toxicity, and they need the utmost levels of civility and diplomacy, and anything else they kind of shut down. They just don't have either the emotional maturity or the temperament for it. Other people rejoice in toxicity, right? So in receiving it. And so There are some people who essentially they find it amusing when somebody, and they pay attention when somebody says, hey, you're an idiot, here's why. Other people, like, they need something that's different than that. Now, what is toxicity as well is there's a bit of a spectrum on it. I'd say that at one end of the spectrum, you have just verbal abuse, which doesn't have any like substance to it. Or even worse, like physical threats or actual, you know, physical violence. I think physical violence is probably the greatest level of toxicity. If we're looking at it, closely, and you know, that's the preferred method of kind of the fiat community, right? Is exerting physical violence. So I think that's out of bounds. I think the threats of violence are out of bounds. I also think that bringing in like family or things like that, you know, or even, yeah, that, you know, that's not something that exceeds my tolerance for toxicity. So everyone has a different level of tolerance. I personally, I'm okay with somebody calling me an idiot. I think that's fine. If they want to do that, as long as there's a substantive argument behind it, right? I think that when there isn't that kind of follow through, and it's, or that the argument is one that's already been debunked, right, a million times, where it's like, okay, this is tiresome because either you haven't done your homework, or you know, you're just like not updating your worldview based on new data or logic. You know, that's a little bit tedious. And I think though that what people complain about with regards to toxicity is when they have what, you know, psychologists call somebody who's disagreeable. Right. So when somebody just disagrees with them, for some folks, that is toxic, right? Like they can't handle that. And I grew up engaging in lots of different intellectual debates. And so that never bothered me that somebody disagreed with me. But some people expect that if you have a different point of view, that you have to either not express it or express it in private, right? That if you contradict someone publicly, they feel assaulted and kind of, you know, disrespected that you actually challenged them publicly to an intellectual debate, even if you're being very civil and diplomatic. You know, some of it might just be like culture, right? So if you have a culture where there's a lot of deference to authority, but it also might be that they are somebody who has lived in a bit of a cocoon of for whatever reason, they've never had anyone ever challenge them intellectually. And so they're surrounded by yes men and brown nosers or whatever it is. So that going on the internet, like nobody cares. Nobody cares who you are, right? You can be Barry Silbert. Like, nobody cares. You know, people are going to contradict you and argue with you. And so, you know, reacting to that as like, oh, the Bitcoin community is toxic because they are disagreeing with me and they won't let it go. And, you know, that to me is just kind of silly. Dishonesty in the sense that that's not real toxicity, right? Like real toxicity is when somebody is kind of adding a layer of insult or of not being constructive, but just contradicting someone and disagreeing with them, I think should not fall under toxicity. But 99% of the time when somebody complains about toxicity, they're talking about somebody disagreed with me on the internet and I didn't like it.
Right. That's funny. I agree with everything you said there. I like Twitter because of the battlefield of ideas. And, but offline even, I feel like we're in an age of untruth, and I'm kind of curious why do you think some people avoid the truth?
Yeah, I think that the truth often demands change from us, right? That we have to change something about what we believe or what we do. So for example, if somebody tells you, hey, look, altcoins are scams, and you are somebody who has created an altcoin, you'd fundamentally like have to change if you were to accept that truth. And that might not like that. It's such a big change. The cognitive dissonance is so much that it's easier for you to just reject it. Come up with a rationalization for why that's not the truth.
Yeah. As we kind of round out 2022 here, and I mean, we have a few months left, but I'd love to get into a little bit of maybe what would be your boldest prediction around Bitcoin for the end of this year?
Great question. A bold prediction. I mean, last year, maybe it was 2021, I made the bold prediction that like half of the S&P 500 companies would hold Bitcoin. And that turned out to be very bold because it was disastrously wrong. So I would dial it back to perhaps something more manageable. Yeah, I guess my bold prediction would be that we only have 3 months left, so it's hard to even be truly bold. But let's say in 12 months, mm-hmm. in 12 months, I think that the Lightning Network capacity will have doubled, and the growth there is going to continue to catch everyone by surprise. And it's going to reflect a lot of actual usage of people using Lightning for payments. One of the nice things about kind of where we are in the market cycle when the price is going sideways, it helps basically people stop like worrying about the volatility, right? And it starts feeling like a stable coin. And so it gets used in commerce more and people start getting more comfortable with it. And ironically, that's what causes the price to start drifting upwards. And then you get everyone piling in, right? And so I think that kind of the payments utility aspect of it, it's going to, continue to grow over the next 12 months, even if the price is just going sideways, especially if the price is going just sideways.
Well, let's get into the Lightning Network a little bit. I always wonder, so Bitcoin, I think, is a very special thing. And I couldn't imagine it being any different in certain regards. I'm not talking about 21 million being, it could be 22 million, but the idea of a supply cap or proof of work or the difficulty adjustment, it just seems to all come together like magic. And Lightning is one of a second layer application. You know, I think you count Liquid as another, and but is Lightning as special as Bitcoin in the sense that we got it right, or is this still a little bit experimental? Are there risks? Are there going to be competitors? I'm really curious what your take is on that.
Yeah, I think that one is that we didn't start. And I say we, I mean, like,
yeah,
like the Lightning white paper was not the beginning. Satoshi tried to implement payment channels in his initial release of Bitcoin. They just weren't secure. So I think that it's kind of been this parallel thread to on-chain Bitcoin from the beginning. And that it it is going to continue to improve, but also that it doesn't need to be perfect in the sense that it just needs to work well for small payments. We'll always have on chain. We can always use on chain for large payments. So I think that when we think about the risk, the reason why even the reason why Lightning can be high risk is because it's low value at risk. And so you know, would never use Lightning for your life savings, but just in terms of using it as a wallet for walking around money, that I think is going to work really well. Whether it's custodial or non-custodial. Now, lots of really brilliant folks working on making sure that non-custodial, is the future. So big props to them. And I think that there's enough being invested in it that it's going to succeed. Now, obviously, it comes with its flaws, as does on-chain Bitcoin, for that matter. It just has to be, it just has to have the right set of trade-offs and also just be open source and be something that we can improve and build upon. I'm bearish on the idea that there's going to be something even better than Lightning coming along that will essentially make Lightning, irrelevant. I think that the fundamental design of it makes a lot of sense.
Got it. Yeah, no, that's really interesting to hear. And I want to check in with you on El Salvador. Last time we talked, you brought up a really interesting point about how President Bukele is young. And so he has that sort of quality to this ambitious play with Bitcoin. But I'm curious what you think of how Bitcoin is, as legal tender, has been going in the country and that project.
I'll be visiting in November, so I'll be able to give you an on the ground report. I think that changing the world monetary system is a multi-decade process. And it's astounding to me that we're in decade two and we've got, a country that is embarking on this. I think that we'll see. It's just an amazing kind of test ground. I hope it's super successful. I'll see you on the ground in November and I'll send some Lightning payments and test it out.
Could you imagine when you and Bitsteam were running around Austin trying to get businesses to adopt Bitcoin, I don't know, 10 years ago? And now a whole country has, sort of implemented that as legal tender.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding. I mean, I think that I don't know if a lot of people are actually using Bitcoin on the ground there. I'm going to find out. Because I still stand by the thesis that Bitcoin's like native internet money. And so Bitcoin adoption is going to happen by internet people like us before it happens to like geographic areas like El Salvador. But I think that it also depends a lot on the regulations. So I saw a map that showed how much are people using Bitcoin for payments in different countries. And it basically, in countries where you have the capital gains tax thing going on, very little. But then in countries that don't do capital gains tax on Bitcoin, it's thriving. So I think that, making it legal tender really makes it able to thrive because it exempts it from that capital gains taxation. And, competition is good. So I think that creating a level playing field between the dollar and Bitcoin is how we see who is the winner.
So what do you make of all these projects around the world, like Bitcoin Beach, which kind of was foundational to El Salvador, and I think it's Bitcoin Island maybe in Philippines, and Bitcoin Lake in Guatemala? Do you think that these are going to be instrumental down the road, or it sounded like a little bit like you thought maybe these would be like footnotes where we remember them, but they're not.
No, I don't think so. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, internet adoption catalyzes into real world adoption. So at some point you reach a critical mass of, for whatever reason, in this area, there's enough Bitcoin users to form a circular economy and kind of snowball from there. So I think it's fantastic. I would just question our ability to like predict where it's going to happen, or like like El Salvador came out of left field, right? You know, nobody except for the folks who were actually on the ground there knew about it until like Bitcoin Miami, you know, and the announcement there from Jack Ma.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about, I mean, in the world right now with oil? So everyone's trading oil. It seems like the petrodollar's breaking down, or at least the monopoly on that. Do you think we'll see a nation state turn to trading oil for Bitcoin in the near future?
I think that there's always this challenge where in order for a nation state to take Bitcoin seriously, I think they have to not have their own currency. And so that was the case with El Salvador. They were using the US dollar, and so it didn't really cost them anything to, whereas a lot of other countries, you know, any kind of somewhat, you know, I think all of the big oil exporters have their own currency. And so they're always going to try to shill their altcoin to, and I remember Venezuela had it literally an altcoin that was like for oil. So the temptation will always be there. Yeah, I don't think that that's, or from what I read, in the near term.
Yeah. So do you think that nation states will be the last to adopt in that regard?
Yeah, the ones that have their own currency will be. What they could do is try to back their local currency with Bitcoin. So build up some Bitcoin reserves that way for that purpose. Maybe if, you know, Bitcoin's price goes up and they see Bukele, you know, profiting from it and, you know, not indebting his nation to the IMF or whatever, that will make them interested. But that's to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. My final question to you. So I think you mentioned once before that, you know, if you declutter internally and you have more space to find your soul in there. And I think that also applies to Bitcoin in terms of Bitcoin is pragmatic about being simplistic in a lot of ways and non-volatile internally. And I think that kind of format sort of helps me be internally more sound and at peace. What are you up to these days outside of Bitcoin?
Outside of Bitcoin, I am building a model boat with my son, that's pretty much it.
So just spending some time with the family. I love that. I noticed you've been on the road a little bit more speaking, whether it's, I think it's at the Mises Institute, or you were at Bitcoin 2022, I believe. So I'm excited to see what you've been putting out there and what you continue to put out there. As always, Pierre, it's been really great to have you back on the show. I leave it to you for any parting words and to let people know where they can find you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on. You can find me at Bitcoin Pierre. Always a joy to be on your show, and looking forward to the next time.
So why the Twitter handle name change?
Well, I locked myself out of at Pierre Auchard. I registered it with a Google voice number, and that voice number expired, and then I couldn't recover the account. So I'm sure somebody has a clever NFT solution for decentralizing Twitter, but I'm not interested in hearing.
So you're still going to run the both accounts, Bitcoin and savings?
Oh, so yeah, Bitcoin is saving. I still have. I was talking about app.
Yeah. So you just, yeah, okay, got it. So you replaced the one that you got locked out of, but yeah. I didn't know if you were transitioning out of that completely, and I was just wondering what was going on there.
No. I have to have an account that's for memeing, and then one that's a little more serious.
Which one's the memeing one? Thank you so much, Pierre. This has been so dope.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Have a good evening.
This episode with Pierre Richard was powered by CipherSafe and CrowdHealth. Please support our amazing sponsors, drop a dope review on your podcast app, and share the show and episodes with your friends and family. TikTok, NextBlock, StackSats, Stay Humble, and thank you for listening. This is Cedric. Peace.